This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
Ah, the satisfying sounds of more sales in your business. And from the sound of it, your business is growing. But you shouldn't have to pay more to scale your business. With Stamps.com, you can import orders from wherever you sell online, find the lowest rates with the fastest delivery times, and instantly deliver tracking updates to your customers and stock up on supplies. Get started at Stamps.com today with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale.
Hey, I'm Morgan from Seattle.
I'm Matt from Essex, Ontario.
Hey, I'm Dan from Dayton, Mass.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Simon Rich hates it when someone pulls the wool over his eyes.
I remember when they introduced the calculator in like second or third grade, just like the horror of, my God, I've been doing this math by hand my whole life. And you had this machine this whole time, you know, you just punch in the buttons, there it is. That's it. And you had it. It's not a new invention. I was thinking about this the other day, like post-Wikipedia, I mean, thank goodness I'm not somebody who ever actually learned anything. You know, I would hate to be somebody who like has spent his life learning things after the existence of, you know, and then Wikipedia comes up. But there are guys out there, there's like 50, 60-year-old guys, like professors, who like spent decades like learning stuff. For what? Like wasted years. It's almost like it would be like a karate expert finding out late in life that there is such a thing as a gun. Like what? So like how far away can you get someone with it? Like further than an arm's length? Well, then what? Then I'm done. I'm out.
It's Bullseye. This week, Simon Rich doesn't write about the way love happens. He writes about the way love feels.
When you find out your ex-girlfriend's dating someone new, it's like she's dating Adolf Hitler. And when you miraculously get a girl's phone number at a party, you know, you sort of are expecting to win a MacArthur Genius grant and get a phone call from the president.
I enjoy that guy. He's got a new book out, Last Girlfriend on Earth. And the first time you hear Bill Burr, you might think he's just a macho, in-your-face type of comic. He famously hurled insults at an audience in Philadelphia.
It goes beyond hatred. I resent when the crowd is in control.
But more often, you'll find him pointing that aggression inward. Plus, Eugene Merman finds an old notebook in his parents' basement. And you'll hear how soul singer Solomon Burke absolutely, positively tears the house down. All that and more this week on Bullseye. Let's go. Every week on Bullseye, we're joined by one of our favorite culture critics to recommend stuff worth your time. This week, it's Mark Frauenfelder of BoingBoing.net. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jesse?
I'm excited to talk about Space Team.
Oh, yeah.
Space Team is a game for, and I'm quoting directly from their website, people who like discharging clip-jawed Flux Trunians.
Yes, exactly. And it's fun because it is a team game. You cannot play it with just one person. So basically, every time you start this game, you're presented with a random control panel on your iPhone that's got knobs and sliders and switches and buttons. And it's like something out of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. All these things are labeled with names like volatile flush clamp, repulsion locator, auxiliary techno probe. So when the game starts, you start receiving instructions to do things like set the 4-stroke plucker to 7 or discharge the clip-jawed Fluxtronian. But the problem is the 4-stroke plucker isn't on your control panel. It's on one of your teammates' control panel. So you have to tell them to do it. And at the same time, they're telling you to do stuff that's on your control panel. So you're actually doing three things at once. You're giving instructions, receiving instructions, and then making adjustments on this incredibly complex control panel that was randomly generated just seconds ago that you have zero familiarity with. And if you don't do things in a certain amount of time, the control panel starts to shake apart with sparks and smoke, and eventually everyone dies.
Mark, I feel like we've had a theme recently, group games that induce yelling.
You know, you're right. That's true.
Let's talk about something a little bit quieter. It's a magazine called The Magazine, which is online at the-magazine.org. When I say it's a magazine, I'm using that in a sort of broad spiritual sense rather than a literal physical sense. Tell me what it is.
Yeah, this is like just something that I love so much, and it could be a model that saves journalism for freelance writers. It was started by Marco Arment, the guy who started Instapaper, and it is a very nice reading experience. It's a lot like reading The New Yorker, but you know, even fewer ads and less obtrusive, obnoxious design. It's just very basic text. And the stories are really wonderful. One of my favorites was an article recently about artisanal ice making, something that I didn't even know existed. Fascinating article. So to me, I just love the idea that this is a new market for journalists, and it's completely subscriber supported. I wish them the best. It's a great experience.
Mark Frauenfelder recommends The Magazine, which is online at the-magazine.org, and the iPad and iPhone game Space Team. Thanks, Mark.
You bet, Jesse.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It seems like Simon Rich has it all together, but his characters really, really, really don't. Rich got his first book deal while he was still in college. That book got him a writing job on Saturday Night Live and a nomination for the Thurber Prize, probably the most prestigious humor writing prize there is. His new book, The Last Girlfriend on Earth and Other Love Stories, is his fifth. It's only 5 years or so later. His short stories are often about people missing crucial information, and since his new book is about love, that mostly, in this book, means men who really, really don't understand women. Really, 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 really. Simon, welcome back to Bullseye. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Jesse.
Here's my question. A lot of your early writing was about, I guess I would say, kind of lost children.
Uh-huh.
And now your writing seems to be about lost 25-year-olds mostly.
Yeah, write what you know, right?
Like, do you feel like you are writing about a version of yourself that is like 6 months in the past?
I like to think more like 18 months to 2 years in the past. But yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, from the get-go, I've always liked to write about I've always liked to write comedy about high-stakes situations. So for a while, my books are about things like the apocalypse and heaven and God and extinction and things like that. But since college, the highest-stakes thing for me has been dating. So I started writing about that. And for a while, I was writing these sort of uncharacteristically realistic pieces about my love life, but they were so boring. And dull, and because it turns out my love life is kind of boring and dull. So I sort of hit upon something a few years ago where I was like, maybe instead of writing about love the way it happens, maybe I should write about it the way it feels. And that's sort of what these stories are. You know, when you find out your ex-girlfriend's dating someone new, it's like she's dating Adolf Hitler. And when you miraculously get a girl's phone number at a party, you know, you sort of are expecting to win a MacArthur Genius Grant and get a phone call from the president. So these pieces, they're weird, but yeah, they're pretty autobiographical.
What was your first date?
My first date was in seventh grade, and I was really, really excited because it was a double date, and a popular guy in the class who already had a girlfriend from a nearby all-girls school asked me to go with him because the other girl apparently had a friend who was perfect for me. And I was really excited. You know, I was amazed that my reputation had spread to another school, and you know, I'd never been on a date before, and it was really exciting. And when I got there, the reason why I quickly realized that the reason why she thought we'd be perfect for each other is because we were both 4'1", and that was the thing we had in common. And the date really consisted of us standing back to back and them measuring us and taking photographs of us. It was more of like an anthropological study than a date. But I you know, she was a very nice girl. I don't think we went on a second date. But I was really, really small. They had to, you know, take me to a hospital and x-ray my bones to make sure that I would grow a bit more. It definitely informed my personality and my writing. I still feel like I am that 4'5" middle schooler sometimes. I think everybody feels that way sometimes.
You know, there's this part of development where all of the girls have their big growth spurt.
Yeah.
You know, like in like 6th, 7th grade, something like that?
Yeah. I remember that. It was like a conspiracy. Coming back from to school in 7th grade, and you're like, oh, everybody is in on this?
What was your first like girlfriend?
I met my first girlfriend at an academic camp, like a lot of writers I know, and it's a miracle when you finally meet somebody. They've done studies. They say it's similar to suddenly trying heroin. It's a euphoric experience, and it's rare when it happens, but when it does, it does feel like a miracle from heaven.
There's a story in the new collection about a guy who has been seeing a girl for a couple of months, and he finally commits to being her boyfriend rather than just a guy who's seeing her. And at that moment, time freezes, and he is visited by alien sex beings.
Yes, they're sex aliens, and they come to him and request an orgy, and he he can't because as of seconds ago he's in a relationship, and he's sort of confused as to why they picked him because he's sort of a schlubby guy and he's not much of a catch. You know, why do they go across the universe? And it turns out that their eyesight is really poor. But their noses are really highly developed, and their sense of smell is really fine-tuned, and they can smell confidence. And the moment that he entered into a relationship, he had enough confidence, and that's why they swooped in. Sort of a relatable experience, I think, for both genders. Somehow, when you're desperate, the other sex tends to be aware of that, and it can hurt your chances.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Simon Rich. His new book is called The Last Girlfriend on Earth. Here he is reading one of the shorter stories, Man Seeking Woman.
You are an intelligent woman with a sweet and caring soul. You're mature and sophisticated, but you know how to let loose and have a good time. Your first name is Chloe. Me. I'm a thoughtful, intelligent guy with a sense of humor. I like to stay up late talking about the big questions. I have a large, irremovable tattoo of the word Chloe on my chest from a previous relationship.
You went to Harvard and wrote at the Harvard Lampoon, which is like this legendary humor publication there. Did you know about it before you, like when you were applying for college? Like, did it factor into your like early admission decisions?
Yeah, 100%. That was 100% the reason why I wanted to go. I was desperate to get in so that I could write for the Lampoon and, you know, hopefully someday write for The Simpsons. That was my whole goal. I had known that a bunch of writers from The Simpsons had been on the Lampoon, and The Simpsons was my whole world. That was my entire life, was just obsessing over that show. And I just wanted any shortcut to to that writer's room that I could find. And I felt so excited when I got in because I would get a chance to maybe work for the Lampoon.
I feel like in one of your books there was a thank you to your mom for letting you watch 6 episodes of The Simpsons a day for your entire life.
Yeah, it turned out to be a not so unreasonable thing for her to let me do. Yeah, I love that show, and I still love that show. And it was sort of the first. I remember writing down my favorite jokes and staring at them and trying to figure out how they worked. And I think every writer just wants to try to copy their heroes, and that's really all I've ever tried to do is just rip off The Simpsons as much as I possibly can.
Do you remember one of the jokes that you wrote down from The Simpsons?
I think the episode where Bart discovers a comet.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that stuck out in my brain as the funniest episode of The Simpsons, and at the time I had all sorts of nerdy technical theories as to why. But I remember every time it being on, just sitting there with a pad trying to like capture it, transcribe it. I was just obsessed with that.
I'm imagining you right now, like sitting at home, staring at a giant, you know, like those poster paper that you use for presentations or brainstorming, and those really fat tip markers. I just imagine just on your wall is written, "I was saying Boo Earns." You're trying.
Yeah. No, I was just a full-fledged Simpsons freak. And if I could go back and tell my 12-year-old self, you know, you might be a foot shorter than everybody, but keep watching The Simpsons. Things are going to turn around for you someday, you know.
Do you have a feeling about what made The Simpsons so resonant for you, besides the fact that it was and is really great?
I think it was that the jokes, not all the jokes, but many of the jokes were relationship-based, and they were story-based and character-based, and they had heart to it. And so much of the humor that I watched growing up was so negative and so nasty. And some of it was really funny, you know. You watch Married with Children, It is some of it is really good, but it's nasty and cruel, and also growing up watching stand up comedy, you know, on Comedy Central, a lot of that stuff was really negative and hostile, you know. Even the stuff that I respected, it reminded me of the bullies who picked on me, you know, at school. That sort of nasty mocking humor, and there was a real warmth to a lot of the jokes on The Simpsons. It felt like it stood apart from the rest of it in its earnestness.
I had a conversation with my shrink the other day, and I was telling him about how sometimes I don't want to watch upsetting television shows. I just want to watch Cheers.
Right.
And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't handle watching Breaking Bad.
Right.
He says to me in that way that a shrink does, where they're asking you a question to tell you something. Mm. He says, "Think back to your childhood. Do you think there's any reason you might prefer a show where all of the conflicts are positively resolved?" But that, I think, is one of the central parts of The Simpsons, is that it is a classic. You know, James L. Brooks made sure that show was a classic family sitcom, which is to say that as much as Homer chokes Bart,
right,
and as much as, you know, they visit a crazy underground world that is ruled by singing jockeys, central to it is these conflicts coming up for a family, a nuclear family, and then them finding resolution to those conflicts.
Absolutely. And the shows that I love, you know, the ones that I'm sure Brooks had in mind when he was helping create the template for those early seasons of The Simpsons, you know, shows like Isle of Lucy or even, you know, The Honeymooners, the way that relationships are dealt with on those shows, you know, there's something really relatable and universal about it.
It's also kind of comforting.
Absolutely. I mean, I would never write a book that didn't have a happy ending. I mean, I can write a story that doesn't have a happy ending, but my favorite writers, they always give some redemption at the end. I think that's one of the things that makes a story gratifying.
So your new book, which is called The Last Girlfriend on Earth and Other Love Stories, I mentioned in the introduction, almost every one of these stories is about a guy who is missing or not getting some element of romantic love with a lady.
Yeah, that's pretty fair.
Which of these are things that you have encountered in your life? Which of these blind spots?
Oh, I think all of these stories are very personal, and I think they're things that everybody has dealt with. You know, there's a story about a sort of Through the Looking Glass parody where there, you know, sort of like a Alice in Wonderland type girl who's alone with nothing to do on her estate. And she meets a magical talking goat in her mirror, and he pops out, and they have adventures, and they steal tea and biscuits and frolic through the woods, and then he tries to kiss her. And she's like, whoa, we're just friends. It's a story about the imaginary friend who wants to be more than friends, but she's weirded out because he's a goat. I think that's something that everybody has been on both sides of, you know, a relationship you think is platonic, and it turns out one of the two people have ulterior motives, and it ruins everything.
There's a great moment in that one where she says, well, this won't work. I'm only 7 years old, for one thing. And he says, well, I'm only 8. And she says, but how is that? What is that in goat years?
Yeah, and he hasn't never really had to respond to that. And she's like, it's mid-50s, isn't it? And he sort of changes the subject. And then, you know, there's a story about a guy who is dating the title story, The Last Girlfriend on Earth. He's there's a plague, and it wipes out all the women and leaves all the men. But his girlfriend just happens to have this freak genetic immunity, so she is the only remaining girl on Earth, and happens to be the one he's dating. And there starts to be a lot of rivalry over her, since she's the only remaining potential mate for humanity, for male humanity. And so, you know, he has to fend off the president, and he has to fend off, all sorts of. He has to fend off Cornel West. All sorts of eligible bachelors, you know, senators and athletes and kings. And I think everyone has been in that experience, too, of being so in love with their partner, but also paranoid that that someone better is going to come along.
Almost always not without exception, but the preponderance of these protagonists, the guys in this situation, are the stupid / blind / pig-headed. They're not the good ones.
No, they're not always the good ones. Sometimes they learn their lesson.
True.
But, I think the present is an example of that. The time travel piece,
mm-hmm.
about a time traveler who. He's a scientist who is very obsessed with building his time machines, but kind of neglects his girlfriend, and gets her the same terrible present every year on her birthday. And 1 year, predictably, he forgets again, and he decides, and she's crying, and he's apologizing, and she's like, there's nothing you could do. It's not like you can go back in time and, you know, get me a new present. So, of course, his eyes light up, and he does just that. And he's trying to think, well, what can he get this girl, you know, to make up for all the years of neglect, you know? And he's thinking, you know, a jewel from ancient Egypt, or, you know, an original copy of Romeo and Juliet or some ancient thing, and he's trying to figure it out, you know, a rose from the Garden of Eden. And ultimately, the present he decides to give her is that he's going to go back in time and make it so that they never met and that she never had to go through the misery of dating him at all. And so there are pieces in there that at least the guy picks up on something.
Have you had that situation come up in your life, like the scientist in your story who works and forgets anniversaries?
Oh, definitely. I think that I think those are very personal pieces. That one, and also, yeah, there are a number of pieces in the book with that motif of a character who is so busy working that they maybe ignore other aspects of their lives. I really, really love writing, and I've always loved it. And it's something that if I don't do it for a few hours every day, I get really antsy. But it's something that I think, learned to balance a little bit better with the rest of my life.
But at the same time, I mean, I know this from my own experience. It is very easy to slip into that and lose track of the other people in your life, because it's easier just to be responsible for one thing that's in front of you.
Exactly. And you know, the stories that you – the problems you need to solve in writing are never as serious as the problems you need to resolve in your life. And, you know, especially when you're a writer like I am, where you're always looking for a happy resolution – you end up with these neat, tidy stories that, you know, real life is never, it's always a lot thornier.
We'll have more with Simon Rich after a break. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Bullseye is a co-sponsor of the 5th Annual Women in Comedy Festival, happening this weekend in Boston. The festival kicks off Thursday, March 21st, with SNL alumni Rachel Dratch and Horatio Sanz performing with other top improvisers from the UCB Theater. For comedy fans, the festival is an incredible opportunity to see some of the best comics working today, not to mention some of my personal favorites, like past Bullseye guest Maria Bamford. For more information and tickets, visit www.womenincomedyfestival.com.
Hi, this is Biz.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host a show about being new moms. Have you ever pretended to be a sleeping rock to make your 3-year-old play by yourself?
How about scream singing to make yourself think you aren't screaming? You're singing really, really loud!
Join us every week for more helpful tips on creative parenting. And remember, you don't have to park your toddler in front of the TV to be one bad mother.
Subscribe for free on iTunes or go to MaximumFun.org.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Simon Rich. He's the author of several books, and up until recently, he was a writer on Saturday Night Live. We're talking about his newest, The Last Girlfriend on Earth. Here's another selection, Dog Missed Connections.
Saw you at the dog run yesterday morning. You were wearing a leather collar and running around in circles. I was wearing a gold collar and trying to have sex with you. At one point, I managed to mount you, and we sort of had sex for a couple of seconds. You shook me off, though, and ran away. I'm interested in getting to know you a little better. We obviously have chemistry, and even though we just met once, I really sensed a connection. I'll be back at the dog run tomorrow morning. Hope to see you there. I saw you at the window of my master's car during the traffic jam. We barked at each other for a while. I thought you made some interesting points. Would love to meet up sometime for a casual, low-key date. Maybe we could go to Central Park together and eat garbage. Open to anything. Spotted you yesterday afternoon helping a blind human cross the street. I can tell you've got a gentle soul and a caring heart. Would love to mount you violently from behind and have aggressive sex with your body. Saw you by the dumpster eating a pile of what appeared to be human vomit. You seem like someone who doesn't take himself too seriously. Not sure if you're male or female, but either way, I'd love to smell your genitals. Let me know if you're intrigued.
You moved to the Bay Area a year or two ago to work for Pixar.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I wasn't sure if you were allowed to say that for a second. I thought, a film production company in the Bay Area. But then I remembered that was only Pixar.
That's sort of all I can say, unfortunately. But yeah, that's why I came out here. That's why I left SNL.
I think that without talking specifically about the work that you're working on, one of the things that's special about the work that Pixar has done in the past, I think, is also one of the things that was really special about your early work, which is that I don't think anyone in the medium of film has ever been able to so wonderfully capture the perspective of childhood.
Yeah, I think they've done amazing stuff. I put them right up there with The Simpsons and with Calvin and Hobbes. I think it's Judy Blume, I think, has amazingly vivid portrayals of kids. But yeah, it's really hard to do the stuff they've done, and I feel like I've learned a lot from them working there. But even before working there, just watching their stuff. I mean, like a story in The Last Girlfriend on Earth, like Unprotected, is basically that's a story told from the perspective of a condom in a teenage boy's wallet who is waiting to finally be used and waiting and waiting and waiting as a as a teenage boy navigates his burgeoning love life. But that story is basically a ripoff of a Toy Story, you know, which is another coming of age piece about a young man told from the point of view of these anthropomorphic characters who live in his room. You know, it's very similar. That was sort of me trying to do a, I guess, like a R-rated Toy Story.
Do you still find it easy to slip into that feeling of being adolescent or being pre-adolescent?
Oh, definitely. I think that my favorite characters to write about are always characters that know less than they should or know less than the people around them. And I think that even though I used to write mostly about, literally about child characters, and now most of my characters tend to be grown-ups, I think I still write from that same place of ignorance and naivety that I relate to. Like, there's a story in Last Girlfriend called I Love Girl, which is from the point of view of a caveman who's in love with a girl whose name is Girl. His name is Oog, but she loves Boog, and it's about his desperate struggle to win her. And that character, you know, he literally he can't count to three. He knows one and really well, and he knows two okay, but three gives him trouble. And he even though he's technically a man, I think he's just as naive and desperate and hopefully as sympathetic as the kids that I used to write about.
What feelings do you remember the most vividly?
Two things. One was knowing that there was information that I didn't understand and being frustrated by that, by sort of the limits of my knowledge. And the other thing was a sort of terror that that things were going to be out of my hands, that things were out of my control. You know, when you're a kid, you don't know. Your parents can just tell you you're going to a new school now. You know, a lot of stuff is out of your hands when you're a kid. And I think those two emotions are, they're not specific to the experience of childhood. I think they're pretty universal. I think everyone feels that way sometimes. That's why you see children appear in so many films that are geared towards adults, because they're, in a way, the child experience is not unique. It's more of like an amplification of what all grown-ups experience.
Can I tell you what really upset me when I was a kid?
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out between the cartoon, the world of professional wrestling, and the show The A-Team.
Right.
Which was the real Mr. T.
Yeah, that is confusing.
It really upset me.
Or is it none of them? Or all of them? I remember when they introduced the calculator in like second or third grade, just like the horror of, my God, I've been doing this math by hand my whole life. And you had this machine this whole time, you know, you just punch in the buttons, there it is, that's it. And you had it. It's not a new invention. I was thinking about this the other day, like, post-Wikipedia, I mean, thank goodness I'm not somebody who ever actually learned anything. You know, I would hate to be somebody who, like, has spent his life learning things after the existence of, you know, and then Wikipedia comes up. But there are guys out there, there's, like, 50, 60-year-old guys, like, professors who, like, spend decades, like, learning stuff. For what? Like, wasted years. It's always, it's almost like, it would be like a karate expert finding out late in life that there is such a thing as a gun. Like, what? So, like, how far away can you get someone with it? Like, further than an arm's length? Well, then what? Then I'm done. I'm out.
Well, Simon, thanks so much for joining me on Bullseye. It's always great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Jesse.
Simon Rich. His book is called The Last Girlfriend on Earth. If you want to hear about Simon Rich's obsession with The Simpsons, head to our website for our extended interview. It's at MaximumFun.org. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I interview a lot of comedians on this show, and overall, they're an intelligent bunch. Comics are sharp, they're articulate, they have a nuanced perspective on life. It's basically their job. All of this is true of Eugene Merman. But as he admits in his new special, those abilities don't always translate to good grades in school. He found proof in his parents' attic.
My parents recently moved from my childhood home, and I had to go back and save everything. Not everything. I didn't try to stop them. I just went to get all my things from my childhood, and I used to put everything in the attic. And sometimes I put things I cared about, and sometimes, because it was easier, I'd put a bag of trash, which came back only to haunt me. But to be like, oh, a notebook I love, oh, a bag of hair. But I found this old notebook. This is an old notebook I have, like all our old notebooks, with my favorite comic book characters and bands and stuff. And this is X-Men and X-Factor and Guns N' Roses and the Eagles. And of course, an anarchy symbol dripping with blood. Because who doesn't understand small localized governments like a 16-year-old? But it had all this awesome stuff in it. And this is, I don't know how it was like for where you went to school, but for where I went to school, you had to have a 2.0 grade point average to be able to leave your campus and go downtown and start a family. And this is an old letter written to my parents. I know it looks like a letter, like, telling my parents I don't have polio or something. Like, you know, they're like, stop, Eugene is polio free. He does not need to go to a sanatorium. But it's actually a letter that says, our records indicate that Eugene has a GPA of 1.28 and is not eligible to be on his own. This is an old report card. It's a new report card. It's an old report card. This is chemistry 10th grade. First quarter, I got a D. And then I was like, I got to stop trying so hard. And then I got an F. And then I was like, well, I do want to leave this terrible place. And I got a D plus and then a D. And then on my final, I got an A. Yeah. Because I knew that if I tried for 3 hours out of the year, I would still understand what happens in Breaking Bad. The only reason to have taken chemistry. This is a handwritten letter to my parents from my guidance counselor when people still used hands. And it says, he is of average to above average ability and does not appear to have a learning disability. I think if something says you don't appear to have a learning disability, it literally means you appear to have a learning disability. If someone, they're like, we can't tell if your son acts like he's disabled or he is disabled. So we don't know. He's doing the same as a person with a learning disability. Like, no one says he doesn't appear to. You know who doesn't appear to? Steve Jobs. Nobody's like, that guy. He doesn't appear to. Nobody brings it up. He doesn't appear. Yes, I appear to. I appear to have a learning disability. Do I? Who knows? I did spend 6 years in special ed. Anyway.
Eugene Merman from his new comedy special. It's called An Evening of Comedy in a Fake Underground Laboratory. It's out now on CD and DVD. What's comedian Bill Burr's problem with rescue dogs? Find out after a break. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI. Public radio. Intentional. Support for the Bullseye podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more. Audible offers over 100,000 downloadable titles. Bullseye listeners might enjoy How Music Works by David Byrne. For a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership, go to audiblepodcast.com/bullseye. If I told you John Hodgman, Kristen Shaw, Mark Maron, and Eugene Merman were on a cruise ship together, enjoying a concert by John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats, what would you think? Maybe that HBO was rebooting The Love Boat? The truth is even better. The Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival is 10 amazing comedians and 4 great music acts sailing the Caribbean. And the best part is, you're invited. I put it all together, and you won't believe who we've got on board. Check out the full lineup and more information at our website, boatparty.biz. Yes, really, boatparty.biz. The Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival. Comedy, music, shuffleboard. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Bill Burr is the kind of comedian you might imagine when you think of that sort of hyper-masculine, aggressive comic. He's got a short buzz clip, a heavy Boston accent. His face is skinny and sort of hungry-looking. He's ferocious on stage. But he turns that ferocity on himself just as much as he turns it on the world. Sure, Bill's against political correctness, but he's always about 3 degrees off from what you might expect. Of course, if you're in a comedy club watching him, you should expect to be surprised. Bill Burr and I spoke in 2010. Here he is firing a bold shot across the bow from his comedy special, Let It Go.
I got a dog recently, everybody. That's like the big thing. Yes, I did. I'm psyched. I went down to the pound. I got one of those free dogs. Free dog. That's how I say it, too. I don't say I rescued a dog. I hate when people say that stuff. They say, she's a rescue. I rescued her. Really? Did you pull her out of a burning building? Did you jump in a river with your wingtips still on with no concern for your own safety? Or did you just go down to the pound and get a free dog and cheap? Isn't that what you did? I did not want to get a rescue dog. I did not want to do that. My girl was all about it. She's like, we should rescue a dog. You want to rescue a dog? I'm like, no, I don't. She's like, why not? I go, because I think a lot of the dogs down the pound might be a little in the head. You ever thought about that? Dude, the shelter is not a pet store. That is like Shawshank for a golden retriever. Why don't we just go down to the prison and rescue an inmate and just roll the dice that maybe the guy was wrongly convicted? You out of your mind? I want a brand new 2009 bulldog, all right? I don't want some 1995 half a Labrador with part of its ear chewed off, you know? I gotta put together its backstory. Every time I go to use the toaster, it starts freaking out. Because his last owner hung him from the ceiling fan every time the Jets didn't cover the over, you know?
So I saw you perform this in the following context, and I was talking to my producer, Julia, about this. It was, first of all, it was a McSweeney's benefit. It was a benefit for 826 Valencia, the literary classes for kids operation.
Slash donut shop they have
exactly.
out here, right?
So
it's all strip malls.
Everything has a theme. It was a very Dave Eggers, Vendela Vida crowd. It was a beautiful book buying and reading crowd. You were performing on a bill with a lot of comics whose tone was
was matched that. I mean, I can't recall exactly who all was on there. I think probably our friend Al Madrigal, but maybe booked the show. But it's a lot of sort of
comics who seem like
charming,
they read.
Quirky comics. Yes, and you followed a dog act, and you know the rule is you never want to follow animals or children. This dog act went out, and not only was it a dog act, it was called Someone or Other and His Amazing Mutts, if I remember correctly. But it was fantastic. This was the greatest dog act.
Oh, I remember that.
It was such a blast. And
they had like hula skirts on and stuff.
Yeah,
the dogs did.
And the premise of this whole dog act is that all of these dogs are rescue dogs, right? And they talk a little bit about that in the act while they're having them jump through hoops and. These dogs are just adorable. It's a man, his beautiful daughter. It's just a completely charming act from 1920.
Okay.
And then you come out and you open with this bit about how you don't think rescue dogs should be called rescue dogs. And it made me wonder if you're at a point in your career where you do the most difficult material in your repertoire in any given context, just to amuse yourself or test yourself.
I don't know why I did that. That could have been somebody in the crowd annoyed me. Sometimes if somebody annoys me in the crowd or just something is said. Or there's also a thing where if just something is so cute and so adorable and you have to go on after it and you have more of a harsh thing, you just have to go over the top with it. It just kind of shocks people into whatever the hell it is that you're doing. But, I mean, I wasn't trying to disrespect that guy.
Your stage persona is, like, about the least chilled performance that could possibly exist. you're a sweet guy in real life, you know, coming over to the house, playing with my dog and everything.
It's all an act. Mispronounce my name and watch what I do to the room. Throw a temper tantrum like a 5-year-old.
Well, we might as well play this. There's this clip of you a couple of years ago performing in an Opie and Anthony stand-up comedy show in Philadelphia.
You're gonna judge me on that? You're gonna blame the victim?
No,
there?
I'm not gonna blame the victim. But it's a truly spectacular performance in more ways than one. I mean, it's like awe-inspiring. In basically every possible way.
Can I set it up before you?
Yeah, tell me.
Defense
please
of myself.
Please do.
What happened was we went there and it was it was like 10,000 people sort of filing in. It was right outside of Philly. These maniacs down there were wearing like Eagles jerseys and throwing a football around. They were like tailgating for a comedy show, and it was already outside. There were lawn seats for like a third of the crowd. So as far as like, you know, for a stand-up show, you got pretty much everything working against you other than the only thing that was missing is it didn't rain. We went out and the first guy goes out there and it was just, I mean, there might have been 2,000 people sitting down and another couple thousand sort of milling around trying to find which patch of grass they were going to sit on. So he basically gets booed off stage. Totally not his fault. It's like broad daylight. The whole thing was awful. And basically I went on 3 hours after that. And the ideal comedy show is about 90 minutes. And they started booing me. And fortunately, I'd been booed before. So the first time you get booed, it's shocking. But then the next times, it's not an unfamiliar sound. So you're just like, oh, this. Well, okay, if this is going to happen, I'm not going to go down by myself. I'm going to take a few of you with me. I said a lot of ignorant stuff, but I was just trying to make them as mad as they made me. And you know what amazed me was the amount of people who saw that and thought, A, that I was in a comedy club, and B, that I just walked out on stage doing that. Like, I got a lot of emails like, you know, you got some nerve. Those people came there to see a show. Where do you get up to? It's like, do you honestly think I would? Why would you do something like that?
So let's hear a little bit of this. And it will be indeed a brief clip. And for the sensitive eared, there will be some bleep profanity in this clip of.
It's going to sound like Morse code.
Of my guest, Bill Burr, on the stage in Philadelphia.
You standing backstage for 3 hours to get booed by this GED and stupid ass piece of crowd. Radio's fall on your head tomorrow.
In my hand already.
You fall out of one of those piece of buildings.
No,
all you and the Liberty Bell.
Yay.
And shove it up Ben Franklin's What do you think about that? All of you m****s, I hope that bridge collapses onto your pathetic lives. Go yourselves. 6 minutes left, and I will be selling my CD after this shit. And the only way you get one is if I throw one at your stupid heads, you bunch of racist morons.
When you're in a situation like that, where you're facing a hostile crowd, and Philadelphia is legendary for its hostile crowds. I mean, they would boo Mike Schmidt off the stage of the Hall of Fame induction ceremony if they had the opportunity.
If he did one little thing wrong, absolutely they would have. I'm surprised when he cried, they didn't.
If he showed up and he'd shaved his mustache, maybe?
Yeah, anything. Anything can set him off. They're like what are those? Those killer bees. You know what I mean? You scratch your head too much, it makes them mad. They just jump on you. It's the same thing. It's the same sort of concept. But I also don't think that it's helped that they've gotten so much coverage.
The question is, you're looking at an audience of 10,000 very discontented people who are booing you, and, you know, or at least many of
them
are booing
you. Some of the most out of shape, ugly people I've ever seen in my life. They were an absolute train wreck of a crowd. They really were. There wasn't really anything redeemable about them. And they were watching, for my money, some of the best comics in the country that night. If you saw the lineup that night, it was insane. 20 years from now, they're going to say all the comics that were on that show. And they treated them like ass. Even the ones that they didn't boo, you had to go out. There was this whole dance for me, like they were shooting at your feet. And it was like, and that's why I went out there so angry, is because I resent, it goes beyond hatred. I resent when the crowd is in control. That's one of the few things that offends me. Like, how dare you?
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the comedian Bill Burr. He sounds like a classic in-your-face, macho sort of comic. But a lot of the time, he ends up pointing that aggression inward. Here's a clip from his most recent stand-up special. You people are all the same.
I gotta be honest with you. I'm kind of like jealous of the way my dad gets to talk to my mom sometimes. You know? Where are all those old school women you can just take your day out on? You know? When did they stop making those angels? Who just knew it had nothing to do with them. They just sit there and let you blow out the lines, right? What a luxury. Right? To fail all day, you come home and download all your insecurities on this other person. How was your day? How the f*** was your day? I'm out here making decisions. Take these kids away from me. Give me a damn drink. Oh, with the tears.
Why do you think you're so so interested in making everything a challenge? I mean, every one of your setups is something where you start with, often a comedian will start a bit by sort of stating something that everyone can agree on, getting everyone on the same page, you know, does everybody remember the Kool-Aid Man? We all know that men are different than women, like whatever it is, right? It's getting everyone on the same page.
Oh yeah, and I wrote volumes of that stuff.
And you seem to start every one of your bits with something like that's the exact opposite. Like it's as though you took a look through your notebook and said, which of these things will upset and bother people the most, and then you went up on stage and talked about them until you found something that was funny about them.
Well, it's more, all this stuff that I say, if I'm not being ridiculous, I do believe. So that's a big thing. And I have to believe it unless I'm being absolutely ridiculous. Like, I love like that style that Will Ferrell does. I wish I could do more stuff like that, but I'm more of a opinionated, like I kind of say how I feel. But there's two reasons why I do it that way. One is people are so educated to comedy, like it's constantly evolving, and like you lead them to the right if you're going to the left, and in the last second, you know, because people, you know, they try to guess where you're going, so you know you can't put the the cart before the horse, so to speak. So it has to do that, and it's also something doing a lot of difficult rooms. It was also a way that I learned to shut people up. You know, I would just say something that would get people to be like, well, why would you say that? I got, well, where's he going with this? And that all came from doing Hell Rooms.
I mean, I think there are other comedians out there who are as aggressive as you, or as no holds barred as you, or as no topic is sacred, or et cetera. There are other comics who have that tone. And what impresses me about your comedy is that you're also not afraid to undercut yourself in that. I mean, you have a bit. I was just listening to your podcast, and you were talking about someone complaining about your material being homophobic because it contains a sort of segment built around the idea of guys calling each other, and I suppose we'll probably bleep it for the radio, but.
Yeah.
And the premise of that bit is actually much more about you trying to figure out how to be a better person.
This is how it works with guys. Anytime you do anything remotely sensitive, heartwarming, anything that's going to make you more of a loving, caring individual, immediately all your guy friends suggest that maybe, just maybe, you want to suck a d- Oh, it's brutal. Even if you do something smart, right? Like it's raining out, he's got an umbrella! What a f***! Oh my God! What are you, afraid of the water? Put your shoulders up, you f***! Jesus Christ! Would you pull that thing out of your f***? Oh, it's brutal!
I mean, a lot of that's special. It's funny. It's basically, I think, I was in a period, I'm just examining my anger. So let it go. Kind of meant two things. It was one, when I get into a bar room debate, you know, with some plumber or whatever, right? And we're going at it. And I will so argue my point to the, just like, I just won't stop arguing my point. And a lot of times people, just to end it, will agree with me. And that's not enough for me. I'll be like, no, dude, don't just agree with me. You know, don't agree with it. And then there's always that person going, all right, Bill, just let it go. So it was a combination of that. And then also me trying to let go of being this, I don't want to be the angry guy. It's the exact dude. I don't want to be that person who creates tension in his house and your kids are afraid when you pull in. I mean, I want them to respect me, my hypothetical kids that I'm talking about, like they exist. You know, come home like one of those sitcom dads, you know, you're whistling a tune, you take off your Bing Crosby hat.
Put on your
Isn't that the guy you want to be?
Zip
right?
it up all the way, then zip
That's
it down
right.
halfway.
Make somebody waffles. Be that guy. That guy that, you know, lights up a room rather than everybody's like, oh, God, Frank's here. Jesus. Is he drinking? All right. I got to go.
Bill Burr's most recent stand-up special is called You People Are All the Same. You can also catch Bill Burr's Monday morning podcast at BillBurr.com. That's Burr with two R's. Every week on Bullseye, we close the show with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. There's this old story that when Solomon Burke headlined the Apollo in New York, he used to set up shop in the house while the openers performed. When I say set up shop, I mean that literally. The story is that while the first couple acts were doing their thing, he'd be in the cheap seats selling sandwiches to patrons, you know, to make a little pocket money. And then a few minutes later, he'd go up on stage and tear the house down. Because if there's one thing Solomon Burke knew he could do, no matter what, no matter how many sandwiches he'd just been selling in the concert hall, it was tear the house down. When he performed, Solomon Burke sat on a huge throne in the middle of the stage. It was huge because Burke was huge in every possible way. He had a huge voice, huge charm. And at his peak, he must have weighed 300 pounds. There's only one great album-length recording of Solomon Burke performing live, but it's enough. It's called Soul Alive.
I want everybody in the house tonight. All around the world, come on and put your hands together. Get up on your feet. Let's shake this place tonight. Let me see you shake your stuff.
It's Washington, D.C., 1983. On the radio then in the district, it's, I guess, Rick James, Lionel Richie, Michael Jackson. In this little club, though, where Solomon Burke is performing, it's nothing about the King of Pop. It's all about the King of Rock and Soul. Soul Alive is a show, a real show, a journey, an hour and a half of a man pulling the audience, pushing the audience, teasing the audience. He challenges the crowd. He says, "You're not with me tonight." They yell back, "We are."
Are you with me tonight?
And by the time he tells them to love his big, fat, fine self, that's what he says, big, fat, fine self.
I'll bring my big, fat, fine self on.
They are mesmerized. They are enthralled to King Solomon. And if you're listening to the album, so are you. On Soul Alive, it might as well be 1983 or 1967 or 2006. What's important is that Solomon Burke is being Solomon Burke. He's pleading and preaching and doing what he did best. That's my outshot.
In the night, there's no one. Don't you feel like crying? Don't you feel like crying? Oh, baby, I need your love.
That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer is Nick White. Our intern is Thomas Madison. Our interstitial music is provided to us by Dan Wally. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. You can find this show and all past Bullseye shows for free at MaximumFun.org. You can also visit us on Twitter, at Bullseye, on Facebook and SoundCloud, where you can share segments with your friends. I guess that's about it. And remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Thanks this week to David LaTulip and Bill Helgeson at KALW in San Francisco for engineering help. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist-owned.
Listeners.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere. Support for NPR and the following message come from Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, who believes that plants and gardening are for everyone. With over 25 years of developing, trialing, and testing some of the most recognized flowering shrubs and evergreens on the market, Proven Winners Color Choice makes it easy to transform dull yards into vibrant, colorful landscapes. Ready to spruce up your yard this spring? Proven Winners Color Choice created the Gardening Simplified Landscape Guide to help you get started with tried and true elements of good planting design. Identify the roles you want new plants to play in your outdoor space, like ground covers, climbers, or attracting pollinators. Then browse garden plans and see which layouts and plants can bring your vision to life. Proven Winners Color Choice shrubs are available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide. Learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.